This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Anna's coat was made of good roast beef, of good roast beef, of good roast beef.
Here's one more thought about food.
Breakfast in bed. Bacon and egg.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
It's big. It's beefy.
The idea of meat, it kind of gets in your head early in America.
Equality is the prime rib of America.
That's a spicy meatball.
Hamburgers. The cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
Burgers, chicken, pork, fish. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says 2 to 3 ounces, maybe twice or three times a day, is a nutritious diet. How we got here, from the hunters of early America chasing pheasant around the woods to the planetary-scale agribusiness of today and the mythology of Samuel L. Jackson's pulp fictional burger breakfast, is the subject of the new book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America, written by Iowa-based historian and former vegetarian Maureen Ogle. And yes, we are a carnivore America. Maureen Ogle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
One of the things that surprises, but it shouldn't really surprise us, I guess it's more of a reminder, is that when Europeans arrived in North America, they instantly saw a place with unlimited land and unlimited stocks of fish and game. And because of the agricultural history of Europe, immediately these European settlers went about going, oh, look at all of this being wasted here. They completely saw a different land than the natives who were here.
That's right. One of the most remarkable things about the settlement of what eventually became the U.S. is that the people who settled it, wherever they came from and whatever condition they came from places of chronic scarcity. And the abundance here, it was just psychologically stunning to people. They went from a world where scarcity was norm to the realization that abundance could be theirs. And what they chose to create an abundance of was meat of all kinds.
And a cow and a calf in the currency of the early 1800s, maybe late 1700s, would equal a quarter of an entire year's harvest of tobacco.
That's right. And without anywhere near the labor and stress. That's right. So, you know, take your pick. What are you going to go for? What Americans went for was livestock and meat. And meat was so abundant that people who visited the colonies and then later the United States simply couldn't believe what they were seeing. It was just unthinkable to a European that anyone would have access to meat and as much meat and as often as Americans did.
Were the growing expectations of an urban American population of having meat whenever they wanted it at a price that they could afford, were those expectations what made agribusiness and the sort of collectivized sort of hugeness of the meat production business inevitable in America?
What I discovered and what honestly surprised me was how much of the innovation that we point to now as being corporate driven was in fact devised, invented, developed, and embraced by family farmers who struggled constantly to figure out how to meet the demands of an extremely demanding urban public who thought nothing of staging protests, boycotts, trashing butcher shops when they thought the price of meat was too high. I think another way to look at it is that what family farmers were capable of producing simply wasn't enough, given that the majority of Americans chose not to live on a farm. I think the story is so complicated that just to assume that it's the relentless search for corporate profits and big food and big agri to blame for everything is just entirely too simplistic.
I'm interested, after all this 7 years of research that you've done, in what you might make of a book like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle about the meatpacking industry, written a long time ago, or the more recent work of Michael Pollan, which suggests we can shed our expectations for instant meat and massive industrial farms with some kind of progressive ideas about nature.
I think I'm the only American kid who never read The Jungle in high school, so I actually had to sit down and read the darn thing. And what a snore that book is. I think I dispatched any mythology about the relationship between, say, meat inspection and Upton Sinclair. I think I handled that okay based on what I learned about him. His book, frankly, gets way too much credit for a lot of things. He just happened to be the guy in the right place at the right time, and he was convenient for the use of President Theodore Roosevelt. Michael Pollan's book is a different matter. Michael Pollan is a terrific writer, but Omnivore's Dilemma in particular grossly simplifies the difficulties of trying to feed an urban nation. It's real easy to blame corporations for every conceivable problem you can think of, and then to suggest, for example, that we should have small-scale local food sheds and small-scale livestock production on pasture. Those proposed solutions do nothing to address the underlying drivers or factors that led to this system in the first place. You're still going to have all those people living in cities who are going to want meat every conceivable way they can get it.
Is there too much of an emphasis on meat in our diets, do you think, to be sustainable with the populations that we're contemplating over the next 100 years?
Because I knew that I was going to get asked this question or something like it, my husband and I started keeping track of how much meat we eat on a regular basis. And it turns out that we eat about 50 pounds of meat a year. On average, Americans eat 227 pounds. I honestly can't figure out how anybody can eat that much meat. So I'm not going to tell anybody what they should do in their diet, but I, for the life of me, can't figure out how I could possibly squeeze, what, four times more meat into my diet. So, it might actually help if we weren't eating quite so much meat, but I guess people like eating a lot of meat.
But it's your view that there's a lot of slack in the system and that we could change things a lot without eliminating meat or without eliminating the efficiencies of agribusiness.
My personal opinion is, given the demand both in the United States and globally, I think that the system we have, despite all of its flaws, and I'll be the first to admit that I don't really want to live anywhere near a confinement operation. I just don't want to do it. I think given all of that, meat packers and farmers have actually figured out an extremely efficient way to supply all that meat while causing discomfort to a minimal amount of people. Now, I know that sounds somewhat heartless, but packers and farmers have systematically pushed livestock production and slaughter and processing into smaller and smaller geographical areas so that they affect fewer and fewer people. They have mechanized the heck out of slaughter. I keep telling people that if we could go back in time 100 years, 120 years, and walk down, say, the streets of Manhattan, where you are now, or the streets here in Iowa, where I'm sitting, there would be slaughterhouses all over the place. It would not be pleasant. I don't know about you. I really, really kind of like how clean the city is where I live, and I like not having to smell farms all the time, and the vast majority of Americans don't. So there are lots of trade-offs. It's just way too complicated to say, man, big ag and big food caused all these problems. Let's just get rid of them.
Maureen Ogle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Don. I really appreciate it.
Maureen Ogle is the author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Speaking of food, 47 million Americans on food stamps, many of them meat eaters. Your conversation is about how important that program is and others to you. We've had EBT for 2 years in Florida, one of you writes, because the economy was so bad there. However, things are going great, getting better. We will be off them soon, but couldn't have made this transition without them. We're very grateful and fortunate. Your story is about food and keeping the family fed at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.